Welcome to Threshold Stories, crossing thresholds one story at a time. I'm your host, Jeff Gora.
Welcome. I'm sitting here at your beautiful countryside oasis.
I love that phraseology, oasis. That's the water in the desert.
There it is. No, it's exciting because I've been out here. I've seen it in many blog articles. You've talked about it. We've gone through it on social media, but right here. So it's exciting. Yeah.
Welcome to nowhere.
No, it's good. It's good. I see how, you know, you spend a lot of time writing and you get inspired.
I do.
By the scenery, by everything around you. So what I want to see is just get a little, dive a little deeper into Jeff Gora, the author, the book, everything along the line. So, you know, you finish your first book, we're working through the second, it's in publishing. And, you know, of course, there's a third on the way.
Chapter 11 was what I was working on this morning.
There it is. There it is. So let's take it back a step, though.
Sure.
You're coming from IT and the corporate world a few years ago to now this time where you're an author, you're writing a fiction book, you're, you know, continuing down this path of being a true entrepreneur. How do you migrate from corporate America, IT, to being an author in the fiction space that generally have nothing to do with one another?
Right. So my father-in-law started this idea a long time ago, but everywhere he ever worked, he kept his business card. And he made like a little montage of business cards where he'd worked. And I was thinking about this since you first brought up the question. So I could have a business card that has me as managing editor of a newspaper. physicist in training, because I was a physicist for a long time. School teacher. Peace Corps volunteer, president in corporate America, and now fiction author, historical fiction author. I guess the only thing that's in common through that's a common theme through all that is how my passions rotate and change. Each time, though, the one thing they all had in common is a desire to touch people, right? As a editor of a newspaper, you want content that means something. You know, as a physicist, you want to see your thoughts create technologies that make the world a better place. As a corporate America guy, you acquire wealth for sure, but at the same time, you have to deliver a value to your customers. So kind of the truth be told, authoring has got more in common with my previous careers than different than my previous careers. This one's a little bit more isolated, though. I mean, four computer monitors and high-speed internet and keyboard that you have to wipe down once a day. That's my main weaponry. I don't have humans around me all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's incredible because you go from this field where you're running a company and you have employees and you're out here every day with a large responsibility to more, like I mentioned before, in Oasis, you have a computer screen, you're writing. How do those go hand in hand in your life? Like, how do you make that transition? Because it's not easy.
It's not. So I was very much excited about selling my business. I'd made some choices that I said, I'm done. I don't want this stress anymore. I don't want that baggage. A compulsion associated with keeping up with not only my industry but my peers, and I was just done with that because it created the worry that comes with managing the finances of a corporation is non-incidental, and selling that and then migrating to something different. One of the things that something different had to have was a lack of concern over all things associated with creating money from other people's efforts. I don't have that today, and that means a lot.
Right. Right. No, that's it. And then, you know, you're coming into this now, we talked about before, where you had all these walls around you to two cardboard boxes. And now it's just, you know, those boxes, like you said, the goal will be to get rid of them at the end of this year.
Yeah, so for those that didn't get that, when I sold my business, you know, all the people went, the customers went, the goodwill went, and I had some paperwork I had to keep, basically two cardboard boxes. And those are going to expire. So I really won't have anything left other than a memory come end of 2021 when I get rid of those two cardboard boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we're here. Book one's published. So I want to dive a little into that book for, you know, people listening and seeing what's going on, specifically with characters. So we talk about characters often and, you know, sometimes they're more important than the story. There's more meaning behind the characters. What are in your life? Who are some characters that define your life?
Yeah, that's a good one. So my wife and I asked each other this question. For her, the character that she thinks defines her is Martha from the Bible. So Martha, for those who don't know, was busy, active, serving others to the point where she would not serve herself. She won't take her own care of her own needs. She was prioritizing the needs above everybody else. She was busy all the time. And she had a kind of a resentment when others weren't doing the same sorts of things. And she eventually had to get reprimanded and told, you know, sit down and shut up and participate in your own life here for a second. My wife doesn't want to be Martha. Let's be clear on that. It's not like she idolizes or looks up to Martha. Oh, by the way, she happens to be more like Martha than most characters. I connected with Tolkien's character from The Lord of the Rings, Aragorn. You know, Aragorn was fit, strong, always appeared youthful, you know, athlete to the core, a leader, very competent and capable in many things, has succeeded in lots of ways, but he was kind of hiding from his true identity. And that true identity meant taking some serious risks that not only could have killed him, but killed his friends and killed his family for that matter. And it wasn't until he took took on that identity, you know, that he became who he was supposed to be. And I also connect with the fact that Aragorn was not very polite, and I've been labeled as impolite more than once. And he's not very compassionate. And I certainly don't have average levels of compassion. Generally, when somebody screws up, I can see the part of it that was their fault more than I can see the circumstance that engulfed them. And that's irking for some people.
Wow. No, that's deep. And that goes specifically into, you know, perhaps someone, if they don't know you and they don't know your story, they don't know what that means. They don't know what's going on, which goes really into the book being fiction, which generally the characters aren't real. However, do these characters have real-life representations?
Yeah, I would say, specifically to one of the characters, I wish they didn't. But, you know, there's multiple characters in the book, but there's three main characters in the book. And as I develop each of those characters, I'm basically piggybacking off of people whom I've really known, or at least I thought I really knew in some cases, and how I really wish they were, how they wish their lives had turned out in the real world. So, you didn't really hit on it, the word fantasy there, but, you know, everybody has a fantasy life. You know, blind people have fantastic visions of things that they've never seen nor never will. We all have fantasies associated with winning the lottery, winning the gold medal, whatever the case may be, the big contract. We just don't accomplish it. And that desire for the fantastic outcome, fantastic meaning the outcome of the fantasy, is part of our DNA. It's how God has architected us. And, as an author, I really get to play out that fantasy. I get to take a broken person from the real world and make them into who that they were meant to be. And I get to define not only how they're broken, but I get to define how they were meant to be. And it's always emotional. One of the things I said I messed up on in writing my first book was I didn't have tissues next to the keyboard. Because I had more than one instance when I'm typing and I've got a tear or 10 tears coming off my eyes and hitting my lap. And I've got to get the thought out. I'm not going to stop the paragraph just because I'm crying because the words are good. And I have to go back and clean up.
Wow. Yeah, see, that's stuff that you don't see. The reader doesn't see. You can often feel it, though. So when you're reading this book, you can feel the emotion in there. Mm-hmm. You can feel that it's deeper than what it is. But, you know, from the author's standpoint, how do you collect yourself? Because if you're getting too deep into your emotions, it makes it harder to write.
It does.
What's the process of that?
So the process of daily writing, for example. I'll answer that question. It's not the same one, but it's related.
Well, yeah.
So I have found that for me, the ideal time to write is when I don't have distractions. And so for me, the home run hours are somewhere between 3:30 and 6:30 a.m.
Right and early.
So I got no need to have a phone, right? There's no reason to check email. If it's an issue at 3:30 in the morning, it's just fine if it's still an issue at 6:30 in the morning, because no one's going to be around to deal with it. And I have my four monitors up, and you know, I have my screens populated with what I think I need. You know, notes. The story itself is up. I use a word processor, a couple of them, in fact, and then browsers. Opened up to different places where I can do research from. And I say research, meaning hear how other people have attacked this stuff before. And I'm constantly tabbing, you know, between screens and writing all the time. And I got a desk that allows me to stand up, so I'm going up and down a lot. So if I get in a half an hour to an hour early in that window, then take a break, maybe to get a cup of tea or a pot of tea, as the case may be, and then come back and do it again for another hour. I can usually see 6:30. I can see sunrise happen and say, this has been a good day writing. And then at sunrise, I can, you know, participate in life with my wife and take care of things in the community as much as COVID lets me do that and stuff like that. So my routine is a little bit, every writer has a weird routine. I know of one writer who rented a hotel room, and they would go there with their laptop / typewriter and go to the hotel room and write. And they would never spend the night there, and they had to deal with the people who own the hotel that they would basically get a day rate because they wouldn't have to clean up after them. So my hotel room happens to be that loft area that you got to explore and meet for the first time.
Yeah, there we go. No, Jeff gave me a nice tour of where the writing happens. And it's so interesting because when you're reading the book and you're diving into it, you can tell it's not just your thoughts. Like it's your thoughts, but it has to be backed by some sort of research, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. You see where the bottom right, there's four screens. The bottom right is the writing, Jeff's writing, what goes on. The bottom left is the research that goes into
the proverbial web browser,
right? Every chapter that goes in there. And then really just, you know, one to use for texts that might come in or things that are going on, but it's interesting when you see and you dive through just how much work is being put into it. Of course, like people know that, but you don't really feel it until you see it. And then when you dive into the book and all the research that goes on, and you know, a lot of this took place, of course, many, many, many years ago.
First century AD. Specifically, right. I targeted Judah, mm-hmm. which is the country of Israel today, Israel and Palestine. But
yeah, however, there's a lot that can be applied to today's world
from this book. Yeah, so I have one of my three characters is a specific mirror image of a personality type, a grouping that exists in our culture today, whom my heart breaks for. It's this window of the 20 to 39-year-old guy who really does not have a mapped strategy to be better than his dad. In general, that's mm-hmm. kind of the drive, and it goes all the way back to ancient Hebrew times. You want your children to outdo you.
Right.
And in general, the dads would teach their kids how to outdo them. Like my oldest son, I taught him everything finances, and he's very stable. My youngest one, I taught him all kinds of stuff regarding fitness and management and recovery and health, and he's a champion athlete, and he'll continue to be a champion athlete throughout all that. But the majority of men in that 20 to 39-year window, their dads aren't teaching them how to kick butt. And they're having to kind of sort it out on their own, and they're really hoping, they hope they can do this with their cell phone, because that seems to be the one place where they kind of all gravitate and they're all experts in, which is very unique. But I know the way God works is he's used every generation of man, pretty much in every country, to spread the kingdom of God. What I think is utterly abysmal and sucks is they don't know how they're going to do that yet, and neither do I. It's like they are truly going into the job of being a spiritual being in the 21st century quasi-blind. You know, they don't have a roadmap in front of them. Mm-hmm. But I have complete faith that they will figure it out. This myth in society that the millennial male is just floating out there waiting for a woman to save him. Yes, that exists to a certain extent, but my belief is no, it doesn't. There are men who are ready for a challenge. You show them the truth, and it's truly the truth. They'll ditch every belief they have to pursue that truth if they just can believe it's the truth. And it's because you guys have been sold to your whole life. Mm-hmm. I mean, since the day you were born, there's been advertisements on your stinking Xbox, mm-hmm. right? Or your iPad, doesn't matter what it is. And it's so challenging for you guys to get the truth and not somehow feel a bit pessimistic.
Yeah, no, I would
say. I say you guys.
No,
because
I fit
you're
it.
In the genre, but it's that's my drive with that character,
yeah,
Mishi.
I fit it in those. Like personally, those around me fit that as well. My friends were all in this group. Myself personally, the part about my father and trying to be better and all that, it hit me a bit too, because we moved to North Carolina 15 years ago.
Right.
We were in middle school. My dad stayed in New York. So my mom and my quadruplets and my sister, we were
so
all
sorry.
Here. So I had my brother at least, and that was it. So we were figuring out on our own how to do all of these.
See, God's
things,
so history is he's gonna show you the truth.
Right.
You're gonna get it.
Right.
I don't know what the cost is gonna be and what he's gonna say, if this, then that, because there's always that metric in a generation, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully he's not gonna say you have to die at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar and wait 400 years. But he has played that card, by the way.
Right.
I'm not looking forward to seeing it. But my conviction is that, like, in the book, the character Mishi gets pigeonholed by his family into becoming a rabbi because it was their turn.
Right.
And he had to be part of that generation. Mm-hmm. When he got in there, he was a scared kid. He had a circumstance that should not have happened. The city of Israel, Jerusalem, got blocked in by multiple legions of Roman military, and they starved him. They couldn't have sanitation within the walls of Jerusalem. And according to my research, there were 600,000 people on the books, according to Roman logs, currently tourists in the city of Jerusalem on there doing their pilgrimage to the temple when the Romans shut the place down. So they ran out of food, ran out of water, ran out of sanitation. They were doing some disgusting things. And this young Jewish kid hid. He snuck food and went and found himself a tunnel, a cave underneath the actual temple. The real temple, the second temple. And he hid out in there, and he gets discovered by a young Jewish girl when he's supposed to literally be the headmaster of the school that was creating the next generation of Pharisees and Sadducees. He was supposed to be the equivalent of the president of Harvard.
Wow.
And he's caught cheating the system by a peasant. And he's got nothing to do except, yeah, I guess you're right, I am a scumbag after all. And then God uses him to spread the word of God by first becoming a slave. You know, in the modern day, man, I don't perceive you to be a slave or your peers to be a slave. I mean, your drive for professional success is as real as any generation that's come before you.
Oh, yeah.
But by God, you would really love to know why you're doing it, other than because everybody else is, and it's money and you got to pay the bills and student loans suck. And you can fill in the blank with whatever you want to say there. But I know God's going to do something. And I felt like that creation of Mishi is that passionate 20-something who realizes he's going to make a difference and he screws up along the way. That's the word.
It. I mean, it's passion. And it goes to no matter what, no matter what you're in, what you're doing, whether you're even godly or not, most millennials have some sort of passion. Like, I am
I know of no exceptions.
Right, right. You could be passion for being ungodly, right? You could be passionate about really anything, but we're in this, I would even call it more of an emotional generation of, there's a lot of emotions going on.
Oh, the media reflects that from whether you talk about the Capitol, the BLM events and all that goes with that. It's alive and well.
Right, right. So if you take this and, you know, there's so many parallels that people can take from it. And then, you know, you get into even just pushing past the millennial bit there. Talk to us about
the other two guys.
Yes.
The first mistake, I'd say the greatest mistake I made in the book is my main female character with all kinds of flaws. I modeled her after a person in the real world who was loaded with flaws as well. And in this case, I tried to make the character in the book, Yael's flaws, end up being used for greater things by the kingdom of God, whereas the person in the real world, there's no evidence for that, which kind of made it really complicated. But she recognized something that I think nearly all Christian. One of the thing that I hit with, let me back up a bit, that trickles into the book is most every woman who gets married today has two things in common, that Christian women, they're told the message that you need to save yourself for your husband. You need to save yourself for marriage. And the other thing they have in common is when they're in their dress and they're standing next to their husband going through their vows, they've already slept with a couple of men. And that's crazy problematic across all of society. The psyche impact, the coping mechanisms they come up with to try to find other people who hang out with them, who preach a message of forgiveness and it doesn't matter. In their core of cores, they know on wedding night it did matter.
Yeah.
Because there's, I'm going to call them protocols, but things they did on wedding night that they'd probably already done with another man, some kind of thing that was supposed to be intimate. And it hurts their soul. And there's not a mechanism to allow any woman to reset that. There's multiple philosophies and schools you can go to address that issue. But in my character's case, she'd fornicated before she got married, and she knew it was wrong. Now, she lived in a culture where the consequence for that is stoning. You can get killed for it. But she also knew that there was an out. There was forgiveness, but it meant taking a great risk. She had to go to Jerusalem and go to the temple and sacrifice an animal at the temple commensurate with the crime she committed. And so she has to run away from home, and this overwhelms her during her sister's wedding. She runs away from home and goes to Jerusalem and experiences some crazy atrocities along the way, and she gets exposed to some Christians for the first time in her life along the way. And since she gets to the temple, it's closed. So her sense of failure skyrockets. She says, I'm never going to be able to get rid of this sin. And of course, I'm not going to blow the whole book, but when she finally gets in and comes up with a mechanism for trying to cheat the system, so to speak, to try to figure out a way to get healed, she gets raped. And talk about complexities. You know, we can all talk about the volume of date rapes and things like that occur. That's always been a problem in every culture all the time. And she has to sort out what that means. And I'm not going to blow into book two, but it trickles through into the outcomes of book two and in the start of book three, in fact.
Wow. That's, it's hard to talk about from, you know, obviously my side of it all, but
sure.
when you're in there and you're reading it, you see it. And I'm sure that, especially that demographic and the woman who can really connect with her, feel it. Mm-hmm. Like you feel it. It's again, back to the emotional side of it.
So my argument is it's most Christian women. Christian women connect with that.
Right. No, that's it. And then this third character. Talk to me about this.
That's the easiest one, and it's also the absolute hardest one. It took the longest to write because it's me.
Right.
So the character's Rufus. He comes from a lineage that he has no interest in. That's mine as well, to a certain extent. And he succeeded at pretty much everything he did. He hit pinnacles. He had successes. You and I are sitting here. Behind me are two world championships participation medals, and I got them 2 days apart. You know, that's not, one is a community's outcome, and I had two in 3 days, or whatever the case was.
Yeah.
And despite what everybody told us, how great it's going to be, how good it's going to be, even when I hit those highest of highs, when I threw $1 million in my checking account,
right?
When I paid off my house that you're sitting in right now, when I'd sold my business, there was still a gap between true happiness and what I was feeling in the moment. Because I knew what I was feeling in that moment was fading. It was flawed. And I needed, this character needed something more to connect to. And it pulled me back to my original days becoming a Christian. When I go all in and on this one thing, and it's going to be the thing that makes me happy, it's going to give me my passion. What's the cost? And what's it mean? That's me, this character. He has to give up his role as legate, over which is the king of the guy who basically runs a legion. He's not a king, but
yeah,
the leader of a legion. A legion was 5,000 men, and so he had underneath him 50 centurions. Each centurion had 100 men in his. That's where the phrase century comes from.
Yep,
a centurion ran 100 men. I guess what you'd call today a first lieutenant in military terms. Wow. So he had 50 first lieutenants working for him, and that still wasn't creating satisfaction.
Wow. The first thing that strikes me from there is, did writing this book help you dig deep and reconnect with yourself, or just kind of reflect on your life?
Yeah, I tell you, I had all kinds of anger that popped out because, I had a lot of issues associated with sexual abuse in my life, my family. That was a big part of my identity. My impoliteness sometimes that I talked about earlier shows up. But I was also able to see how adventurous I was and how much of a risk taker I am and how willing I am to be optimistic about an outcome when the world has a generally either a neutral or a pessimistic approach to it. And it's really helped me, formulate Threshold Academy to a lot of extent. The things I've chosen to do, it's varied over time because of my writing. I'm discovering me.
Yeah. No, that's it. And then, we talk about Threshold Academy, we talk about writing this book. There's a good mixture going on between real life stories, things that have happened, and nonfiction. So it takes a creative mind to do that. How do you get into this space of, okay, I'm going to write this book, but I'm going to take stories that have truly happened in the world, in the past, in history, mix it with my own life and my own reality or my own futures or whatever. How does that happen?
So if any writer ever tells you an answer other than one sentence at a time, they're a fraud. Because I had an outline that I never stuck to.
Wow.
Right. As you start writing, characters, whether we like to admit it or not, they're a product of their last sentence. Just like you and I are a product of what happened at 2 o'clock today.
Right.
Or at 3 o'clock today. Right. So when it's not even four yet, but that trickles through into the character creation process. I try to keep in mind what I want to happen at the end. Right. At the end of the books, I want people to have hope. At the end of the books, I want people to say, gee, I never thought about Jesus working like that. And I want people to say, God, we really suck. I mean, we are sinners at our core. The things we do are God-awful. Like, there'll be somebody in the 22nd century, I perceive, writing about the events of 2016 to 2020.
Oh, yeah.
And the outcomes that they're going to describe will not match the hope that it's seen in the present. Like, there's a lot of people who stare at the events of BLM and the things on our Capitol building and COVID, and all they see are negative. They see pessimistic outcomes. They see continually degrading society. But there's also lots of things going on. There's lots of hope. There's lots of God's hand touching people. Things are, in a lot of people's lives, better from a lot of this. I've known families who have seen COVID show up in the families, and it has drawn the community together through support. You know, people are getting love that they should have been getting all along, but it took somebody in the family being on the edge of death for that to happen.
Right, right. No, I mean, you look at it that way, and that's one thing about yourself and writing this book is you can look at anything that's happened in history or even just right now from the negative view. But if you spin it, you know, you do see families where right now with COVID and everything going on, reconnecting relationships, building relationships with each other because they're spending time together, getting back on fitness journeys, whatever that is. We talk about improving yourself and all that. But when we look back on yourself and when you wrote this book, you picked a timeline that's nowhere near today, right? Why did you pick this timeline? And what is that important
to you? Anybody who goes to church has components of their pastor's message that gravitate to him and others that don't. There's this fundamentally taught message that says when Jesus died and there was a message that Peter saw, 3,000 people get saved in a single day. The assumptions are the church just skyrocketed in growth every day, just like that day. Mm. It's like every day was the first day at Carowinds. Oh, by the way, that didn't happen. The real event that caused Christianity to go nuts, which is crazy, but it's a blend between bananas and nuts. That's what banuts means, was when the temple fell and all things associated with the prophecies in the book of Isaiah that talked about the fall of the temple, the references to the fall of the temple from Jesus himself, all that came to pass and people said, gee, there are no unchecked boxes for who the Messiah is and what he's going to do. That guy was truly either a nut job or what he said was the truth and we need to believe him in what he said. And it was that event that isn't talked about, discussed. And what's sad, and this is the generational message again from before, the Jesus died, you know, 33, 34 AD-ish, depending who you ask, 36 in some models. And the temple didn't go down until 68 AD. So you're about 30 years, wow, which is perceived to be a generation, a lifetime back then, because lower lifespan. Mm-hmm. And this generation that was alive and owning the business world and owning the agricultural world didn't know anything about Christ other than he said, she said. No one knew him. When the temple fell, the number of people who were in that city who knew Jesus, who had seen him, was very small. Mm. His whole generation had passed. This was kind of the moment when everybody went, wow, look at that. It was a jump start. And I realized there was lots of stories there to tell. You know, I might come back to this in genre in the future.
Right. Wow. No, that's, yeah, that's incredible, especially, you know, it's interesting as we're talking about all these different topics, they all have something to do with each other, whether it's the generational ideas, whether it's even talking about now with social media, right? Like
right.
If you think about how 30 years from now, let's say you pass away, it's much easier for people to know about you and what's going on.
That's right.
It's more rare to find someone who wouldn't know Jeff Gore or couldn't do a simple Google search, right? Like it's so crazy, but that's when you think through what's true, what's not true, what's going on. So in this book, as the author, how much does your storyline stick to the truth?
So I'll give you an answer using the start of book two has a prologue, and it's all it does is it plays a catch-up on the real history of, in book two takes place in 81, 82 AD. Mm-hmm. It's a real prologue about what was going on in that period of time, and then it contains a synopsis of book one, so you can see how the fiction has molded itself into the actual history. It's like I'm doing the equivalent of talking about George Washington's twin sister. We got no reason to believe he had one, but there's no evidence that says he didn't either, right? So I feel like I'm telling a story that parallels, you know, Abe Lincoln's cousin kind of story throughout the whole thing. So for the most part, I needed to make all the events that occurred parallel to a real thing in history that people could connect to.
Yeah.
Now, there's no thing that I can say is absolutely false. I didn't say if the history says it's Tuesday, I didn't put it on Wednesday.
Yeah, right. No, that makes sense. And I know, you know, we've talked about this before. Was there a big part of writing this book that makes you want to get creative with Christianity, with people wanting to build this deeper relationship with God or with their religion? Is that a part of this all?
Yeah, it is. One of the things you're going to see in my themes of my writing for throughout the rest of my days here on earth is the view of Christ, the relationships associated with Christ and other Christians have truly evolved to match culture. I mean, Christ is the same. That's not on the challenging block for anybody who's a writer. But how that interface looks, you know, right now in Africa, as my friend Dan teaches, a big part of who Christ is on that continent, the manifestation, is a lot of healing. People, he goes over there and he prays with people and he sees lots of people healed all the time. That does not happen in the United States at the frequency that it does in Africa.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But we also have technology delivering Christianity today in a way that is unmatched in the history of planet Earth. And I think it's going to be very interesting for me to talk through the Christianity evolution that associated with the Revolutionary War. That's the theme I want to deep dive into. Mm-hmm. And the Renaissance. I'm going to have a whole series, I hope, one day about the creation of Constantinople, the migration of the emperors from being killers and destroyers to champions of the faith. It took 1,500 years, but mm-hmm. we got there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's going to evolve. And maybe at the end of my life, we'll have a whole virtual reality Jesus.
Right.
As people walk around with goggles and whatever the case may be, where his presence appears in a format that we can't even describe yet.
Very well. Wow. Yeah, no, it's crazy. So we'll see what goes from there. And there's, you know, from here, I want to take two lessons. One is a bit of a reflection, and two is a bit of looking forward. So the first, as the author and the thinker and the man behind the book, what did you learn from writing this book?
Gosh, I'd say number one is don't write about people whom you have failed relationships with.
Wow.
That was a mistake. Relationships perhaps that are ongoing, relationships that are positive. I would never do that again. That was poor decision making.
Why did it re-spark some anger? Or like
it did. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, events that, you know, things that happened to me in the real world that I didn't deserve. Mm. Those got rehashed and things that I wish I'd said. And then picking people, I tell you one thing that was really good is I took two strangers, people I didn't know from Adam. It's just a picture of a mother and daughter I found left over, people I've never met. And I was able to stare at that picture and create personas and characters based on just the image. In the real world, I have no idea who these people are. I've never met them. But just going with a mother-daughter picture and going from there to create personas, that was brilliant. My creative juices went to warp drive on doing that.
Wow. And who were these two?
No, just random people whom I've never met.
I mean, yeah. Wow.
But just a mother and daughter.
That's a good lesson. That's a little behind the scenes right there on it how is. You
that's
get...
That's me talking about the bathrooming of writing because the background on the stories.
Yeah.
It was interesting when I was writing the character Rufus for me, I put some graphics up of me on my screen so I would look at pictures of me. And it was a challenge to figure out which picture represented the me I'm writing about. Because I could put the me in my national team uniform, the me in my Boy Scout uniform, the me in my swim trunks, the me who's mowing the grass, the me who's working in the garden, the me who's cooking and who's doing the laundry. As I'm looking at you right now, I'm shaking my head thinking, I don't even know if I can tell you which one I pick because I end up picking a couple of different ones.
Wow. No, that's...
I'm a visual person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
My books are color. The next book's going to have graphics and stuff inside of it, too.
The next book is what I want to cover, too. So what's on the horizon?
So The Emperor and the Ring, which is a sequel to the first book, takes place 13 years after the end of the first book. I've already got the contract from the publisher for that book, and it's in the final editing stage right now. And that'll be coming out probably at the end of Q1 of this year, potentially as early as March, but no later than May.
That's exciting.
And that'll be on all the same platforms, the Barnes & Nobles and Amazon, Goodreads, and all that stuff. The final book, The Seeker, that when it comes to the end, the Weaver, The Seeking and The Weaver. The Weaver and The Seeking. It's going to have something to do with weaving and seeking. Got to get the words right there. Yeah. But that one I'm writing right now, and that'll be released before the Christmas season of 2021. So that'll also come out this year.
Wow. Yeah. And thinking through that, just one last behind the scenes question that came up is how long did the first book take you?
18 months.
And is that longer than the second and third? Because you were thinking about the second and third?
Okay.
Got it.
No, there's a routine establishment that occurs as a writer.
Yep.
And you also got to manage your own emotions, because any writer is going to have a lot of emotions. Same as like an artist. When I write music, I have times when I've just absolutely collected the right riff and I love it, and I get stuck. Mm-hmm. Writers are the same. I got times when I'd finish a chapter and it's like, that is such an awesome chapter, and then I get stuck and I can't start the next chapter. Mm-hmm. Everything I'd write is below par compared to the previous chapter, and that's no good.
Wow.
Now I got a routine. Thanks for listening to this chapter of Threshold Stories, Crossing Thresholds, One Story at a Time. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or on my Facebook page at Jeff Gora, Team USA.